Putting to the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development, a couple of changes and announcements to our agenda. First of all, we're going to carry over SB 5, and we are going to start with SB 43, then go to SB 252, and then go to SB 290. We don't have the fiscal paperwork necessary yet to take any action on it. It may come within the hour. It may not. And then SJR 24. And SB 330 before SJR 24. Mm-hmm. So let's open up a public hearing on SB 343. Senator Monroe is here, and Gary Andine. Why don't you read the summary?
Yes. I'm going to read a quick summary of the bill they'll be discussing. This is Senate Bill 343, and it adjusts calculations of cost of education for private institutions of higher learning for the purpose of the Oregon Opportunity Grant to take into account public institution cost reductions as results of public funds.
Mr. Chair, Rod Monroe, Senate District 24, and you have my written testimony. It's brief. Independent colleges amount to less than one half of 1% of the state's higher education budget, yet they turn out over 30% of all bachelor's and higher degrees graduates. Students going to independent colleges save the state over $150 million each year in terms of what it would have cost to educate them at public institutions. Financial aid to these students provides access for over 30,000 of them to go to school at our fine private universities. Tuition rates at independent colleges are higher than at public universities. However, thanks to grants, discounted loans available to over 90% of the undergraduate students, their college debts are partially kept in check, certainly not entirely. Students that go to private universities graduate faster at a higher rate than those that attend our public schools. Private colleges and universities also are highly diverse. Many of the students are non-white. Many of them are over 24 years old. Many of them are transfer students, often from community colleges. The family income distribution of students at independent universities and state universities is almost identical. The misnomer that somehow private university students are, you know, from a more privileged or wealthy background is simply not true. They're almost identical. Also, many people are concerned about whether or not about the separation of church and state. So this bill makes it very clear, and under the current process, that those seeking degrees necessary to go into the clergy or other religious occupations are not eligible for grants. Thank you, and I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? Senator, I know you have some pressing business. Thank you for coming down.
You bet.
Mr. Andine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Hass. For the record, my name is Gary Andine. I'm the president of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association. I know you've already received my written testimony, and I'm not going to cover that again. I'd just like to highlight a couple of items. Your administrator tells me you're all very good at reading written material before the hearing, so we'll save some time there. I'd like to speak to two things about this bill. One has to do with equity. This is a bill about equity, equitable treatment of Oregon's college students wherever they choose to attend college. Students who are eligible for Oregon Opportunity Grants are all struggling with finances. They are all low income. They may be out of work, recently laid off, first-generation college students, ethnic minorities, from single-parent households, on food stamps, on welfare, living on unemployment checks. They enroll at our community colleges, our state universities, and our private colleges. They don't change their status. They don't become less poor or less Oregonian when they choose to enroll at a private institution. No one asks why many of these students choose public institutions, but when they do make that choice, they are asking the taxpayers to pay a substantial part of their way through college. Thousands of dollars per year per student in subsidized tuition benefits. In fact, the taxpayers provide that same level of assistance even to wealthy Oregonians who choose a public institution. Those who choose a private nonprofit college and are in the same serious financial need are asking for some modest, equitable financial assistance from the taxpayers, even as they and their families and private donors take on a greater personal responsibility for the costs of their education. One would think this is the kind of behavior that would be encouraged rather than discouraged. So this bill asks that when one of those financially struggling Oregonian students chooses a private nonprofit college in Oregon, the legislature show at least some of the same support for that student's commitment to a college education that you would show if he or she had chosen a public institution. It's just the equitable and the right thing to do. The other point I wanted to touch on is that this is a smart bill financially. Over the past 20 years, all three of our higher education sectors have seen enrollment growth, expanding capacity by more than 20,000 students at our private colleges, by almost 30,000 students at our state universities, and by over 30,000 students at our community colleges. We're going to need all that capacity and more to even approach our 40-40-20 goals. That first 40 represents baccalaureate and graduate degrees, and about one-third of those are generated by Oregon's private sector with almost no public financing responsibility for that capacity and that output. 20 years ago, 57% of the undergraduates at our regionally accredited nonprofit institutions were Oregonians. Today, only 47% of the undergraduates at my institutions are from Oregon. That drop from 57% to 47% represents seats that could have been filled with Oregonians if there were sufficient state student aid. Those would be Oregonians not adding to the overcrowding at our public institutions, and those would be Oregonians not leaving our state to find more generous student aid offers someplace else. The bottom line in these difficult financial times is that more partnering with Oregon's private sector resources and private sector donors generates college degrees at far less cost to the taxpayer than total reliance on public, on building out and filling up our public sector institutions. These are certainly the kinds of conversations and partnerships that we look forward to undertaking with you and through the auspices of the new Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Senate Bill 343 is one small piece of that partnership that just makes common sense. I'd be happy to answer any questions about the bill, how it works, what it costs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Gary. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Andine. I wanted to ask, I know Senator Monroe made a statement about not applying to for example, clergy study, but I don't see that in the bill. Is that because of some definition that or drafting that's not in this bill?
That's already in statute. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, that's already in statute.
Thank you. Wanted to clarify that. Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes,
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know I asked you about this in advance, but I just wonder if we could have for the record. I asked you about there's maybe a perception that many of the private colleges have endowments that may not be in existence in public colleges or universities. Do you want to talk about that just a little bit? And certainly they're not all the same, but I'd like to get a little information on the record about that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, thank you for the question. These are small private colleges in Oregon. The largest one is a little over 3,000 students. By national standards, that's considered a small private college. The endowments are not large. The entire endowment of all 20 of my schools is not as big as the endowment of the entire Oregon University system. Some of the schools are better equipped than others, as you note. some of the schools with the smallest endowments do the most to help the lowest income students in our state, and I'm proud of that.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mario Parker Milligan, Charles Bryant, and Kevin Cronin.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Capitol.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mario Parker Milligan. I'm the student body president at Lynn Community College in Eugene, as well as the board chair of the Oregon Student Association, representing over 100,000 students in public post-secondary education institutions around the state. I'm here today on our spring break speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 343, and then I would like my peers Charles and Kevin to share their stories as well. This is not the time to be fighting for which institutions deserve what portion of the ever-shrinking opportunity grant. We should be spending our time on increasing the size of the grant so more students can receive the help they need going through school. 8 out of 10 students in Oregon that qualify for the grant do not receive an award. Early cutoff dates and dwindling funding leave students in a tough position. I used to receive the grant, but because of a lack of funding, I am at the bottom of those who no longer qualify for the award at a public community college in this state. One of the main arguments for this bill is that public schools are subsidized by the state. In reality, these are public institutions that are accountable to Oregonians in a way that private institutions are not. Public schools are scrutinized on their affordability, and for that reason, students who are low-income and attend those schools receive a little larger grant. My peers and I have chosen more affordable institutions because we needed all the help we can get to afford school. Please don't move hundreds of thousands of dollars of the grant to private institutions that are not accountable to the state's affordability measures. If you increase the maximum award amount for students attending these private institutions, that will undoubtedly limit funding for other students. We only have so many Oregon Opportunity Grant dollars to go around. Lastly, as the economy has worsened, Oregonians are going back to school to enhance their skills and better compete in our workforce. As enrollment numbers skyrocket, students are going back to school to further their education, and this is not the time to increase the maximum award amount for students at private institutions when we should be focusing on getting more students in and through school. Please vote no on SB 343, and let's spend our time and energy finding increased funding for this vital grant. Thank you for the time, and now I'd like Charles to share his story.
Go ahead, guys. Just start off with your name. And
good afternoon. My name is Charles, like you said. I also live in Eugene, and I'm a student at Lane Community College. Charles O'Brien.
Sorry. Your last name.
O'Brien, sorry. I'm also a member of the Oregon Student Association, which, as you said, serves over 100,000 students in public universities and community colleges. I do receive the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Today I'm here to share with you my experience with the grant, explicitly our opposition to the changes outlined in SB 343. This bill would move hundreds of thousands of dollars from public school students to private school students who may already have a more affordable alternative to obtaining an education. First, students around the state do not believe that this year is the year to be pitting students against each other. We should be focusing on the increased funding for the grant and the governor's recommended budget instead of finding new ways to slice the same pie. That is a real concern for students around the state and public institutions. I attend LCC because it's the most affordable option for me. I receive the Oregon Opportunity Grant and work to pay for school. After I receive my AOT, I plan on transfer to the UO to pursue a dual bachelor's in early childhood education and sociology. By the end of my year at LCC this year, I will have accrued $26,000 in student debt. By the end of my bachelor's in two and a half years at UO, I'll have accumulated more than $70,000 in additional debt. Personal stories also play a big role in students' abilities to pay for school, and I'd like to share a part of mine with you. I grew up in a very small rural town in Mississippi, and it's not easy to grow up as a queer-identified student there. I was ostracized from a very early age in my town, and that included my family, so it eventually led to our separation. Just before my high school graduation, I was homeless. I had no means of support financially or interpersonally or with anybody around me, and I had to go forth into the world with no means and circumstances or how to live with those circumstances. And so I had to focus all my energy in the 5 years between turning 18 and 23 when FAFSA says that I no longer had to claim my parents' income. All I had to do was kind of just wait it out for 5 years and endure at minimum wage and no education. And I'm not the only person who had to do that. The idea of the bill shrinking the Oregon Opportunity Grant for public school students seems like an unnecessary struggle. So today I come before you to ask that you make the journey a little less difficult. The bill pits choice and affordability, public school students against private school students. Please continue to help public institutions bring in low-income students and make the best use of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Cronin. I'm 21 years old from Eugene, Oregon. I'm a history major, dually enrolled student at Layton Community College and the University of Oregon. I'm here today with the Oregon Student Association and the Oregon Community College Student Association to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 343. Initially, when I received my financial aid offer from the University of Oregon as a transfer student, I was awarded the Oregon Opportunity Grant. As such, I was qualified for it. Since I was corrected my FAFSA later in the spring, I did not receive the grant in the fall. This year, I'm taking on $8,250 in debt in order to go to school full-time and be able to pay my rent. I can only imagine these debt numbers are much higher for students at private institutions, but unfortunately, I was forced to choose the lowest cost institution I could find. The Oregon Opportunity Grant would allow me to take an additional 3-credit class, bringing my course load up to 15 credits. With a bachelor's degree requiring 180 credits, a student must maintain 15 credits a term in order to graduate within 4 years. I am facing a future where I must take on even more debt because I will be unable to finish my bachelor's degree in 4 years. I'm expected to graduate in the winter of 2013, where I will be facing $22,000 of debt. I'm fortunate that I'm not facing $44,000 of debt because I worked 2 jobs while I attended community college in order to avoid debt. I find that in the current economic recession, it is difficult to find employment while attending the university. I'm here today to represent students around the state with stories very similar to my own. I am sympathetic to students who choose private institutions, and I understand that there may be a better way to dole out the award, but moving hundreds of thousands of dollars from public school students to private school students in this recession is not the answer. Please vote no on Senate Bill 343 and spend our time on and energy on finding more funding for this vital grant instead of fighting amongst ourselves. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
Senator Morrison. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. My question would be, what is the grant award you received today, and what would it be if this bill were to go into effect?
I no longer receive the grant, so I can't answer that question.
Mine's already been cut, so mine would just be null. Mine's, I think, less than $1,600. I'm pretty sure. For the year.
I was initially awarded $500 of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. You have to apply within the first, 4 or 5 days in order to even get the grant. So,
I can't answer your question, but we can definitely look into it and give you a response within the week.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair, I guess I'm referring to the previous testimony by Mr. Andine, and if I might read that. Overall, SB 343's impact would be that some of the smaller sub-maximum awards would rise to the maximum ceiling of $1,950, and the cumulative cost of these increases would be merely about $100,000, less than 0.1% of the program's budget. Among those benefiting would be the half of our opportunity grant recipients who come from community colleges to finish their baccalaureate degrees at local private colleges. And if that is the nature of the redistribution, so to speak, it seems to be quite minor in terms of the recipients that are presently receiving. So if there's different information, then I would encourage you to provide that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just want to thank the students. This is the second committee today where students have testified, giving up some of their spring break to come and testify about issues that they care about. These three students happen to be from two of the schools that I attended, LCC and University of Oregon. So I just want to thank you for taking your spring break and coming to the legislature and giving your testimony.
Thank you.
We are lamenting the fact that you have all this debt. Because when we were down there, it's a different story. But we're working on that one. Thank you.
Thanks.
You make us seem old, Mr. Chair. Thanks for doing that.
Susan Deggan and Bridget Burns.
Good afternoon, Senator Haas and committee members. For the record, my name is Susan Deegan. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission in Eugene. You already have my written testimony, so I will not read through it. I will just summarize a couple of key points. Our agency has no position on this particular bill. We are neutral on this bill. There are just a few minor changes that this particular bill would make to the formula that we use to calculate awards. It does not increase any of the student awards as they currently exist. It increases the portion of the formula that we use to calculate award amounts by a certain percentage for students who are attending 2- and 4-year private nonprofit institutions in Oregon. At least that's the way the bill is written. It does so happen that we do not have any 2-year private nonprofit institutions in Oregon, so the net effect is that the result of the bill is that it affects only students at 4-year private nonprofit institutions. We have run some projections on this proposal. Because it does not increase award amounts, essentially the cost is neutral on the bill. There's very little change in the number of awards or the dollar amount of awards that would go to students at private nonprofit institutions. And that's based upon looking at the total pool of applicants for opportunity grants for the 2010-11 academic year. We don't have a large enough pool to look at the 11-12 academic year at this point, so we looked at the most recent largest pool of applicants. The net effect is minimal. There's also no cost in administration, no change in cost at all in administration of the program. One thing that we would like to recommend is that if you were to approve this bill, that you change the start date for the bill. Currently, in Section 2 of the bill, it requires that the change start with the 2011-12 academic year. We have already completed the awarding process for the 11-12 academic year, so we would recommend that it be moved back to the 12-13 academic year. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions if you haven't.
Okay, stand by. Bridget.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bridget Burns. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm the Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. Today, I just want to speak briefly about the contents of this bill and our perspective. First, I want to point out that we view the independent college sector as a valuable component to achieving the 40-40-20, and we know that they are allies on our side in trying to further educate and raise the educational attainment level of Oregonians, and we value them for that purpose, and we look forward to working more closely with them with Senate Bill 242. However, I served on the Access and Affordability Working Group, which designed the shared responsibility model, and I can tell you, because Mr. Andine also sat on that work group with me, that there are a lot of levers and triggers within the SRM that is a very intricate and delicate formula, and it was based on a similar tuition assumption for all campuses. If you're going to change the tuition assumption for one particular set of students, you should probably invite all affected parties together to revisit the formula overall, because there are unintended consequences with messing with such a delicate formula. But further, I would say that rather than focus our energy on changing the award size for different sectors of students, we should be focusing our energy on how we can increase the overall size of the Oregon Opportunity Grant so that all students can be served. Right now, a lot of our students are being cut off because the deadline is so short, and we have a lot of students who aren't even eligible to receive the grant because it is not fully funded. And so it would be our hope that we would focus our unified energy amongst the independent colleges, the community colleges, and OUS so that we can fully fund all students in Oregon who are eligible. And thank you. Take any questions.
Yes. Senator Morris, did you want to restate or re-ask your question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You heard me previously quote the testimony by Mr. Andine at the cost of about $100,000, and I see in your testimony that you say it's about $121,000. So it's still relatively small.
Yeah, Senator House and committee members, yes, it is relatively small, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Further questions or comments? Thank you. Anyone else here on Senate Bill 343? If not, then I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 343. Thanks to all of you who came down. And we will move to a housekeeping measure the committee has, which is to send Senate Bill 252 down to the Ways and Means Committee. I need a script. I'd like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 252.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 252 as amended with a due pass recommendation and a referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 252 with a due pass recommendation and its referral to Ways and Means.
As amended.
Are we not moving this without recommendation? I'm sorry.
Discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that this is the bill that we talked about that we were going to move without recommendation?
Mr. Chair, it would be my preference to move this with a recommendation and send it with that strength. Obviously, Ways and Means will make an informed decision with respect to where this goes and how it's treated, but my personal preference would be to leave it as stated in the motion.
Okay. Further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
I do have some concerns because this originally had a funding source which was removed. And so my concern, as much as I support the policy, is just that I have a concern about where the funding will come from. And I understand that's up to the Ways and Means folks. And as much as I support the policy, I remain concerned about taking more money from the K-12 budget. So I'm going to make that statement for the record. I will support the motion and out of respect for the chair and others, but I have concerns about taking more money from our K-12 budget when our schools are facing such serious cuts.
Okay. Further discussion? Senator Shields.
Chair, this was the bill where we decided to hold it over until we had all five members So you've heard the saying that consistency is the hobgoblin of a small mind, but I think I'm going to stay consistent here with my previous, and so I would feel more comfortable sending this down without recommendation, so I'll be a no vote on the motion.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Maybe I encourage a little bit more discussion, because when I spoke with the proponents, they said they would rather have it with a unanimous vote than with a recommendation. So rather than leap forward, I mean, it's up to you, Mr. Chair, how you want to handle it. But if that's what the proponents wanted, then certainly it's your call.
I would like, I think our job here was to look at the policy, and it's the Ways and Means people to look at the money. And so I think I approve of the policy, and I support the policy change, and I think we have done our work here, and this is not moving to the floor. I think what the do pass recommendation does is say that we do support this policy. That's how I read it. So I'm ready to move this one way or the other. So there's no further discussion. I'll have the clerk call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes, and the measure goes to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation. Close work session on Senate Bill 252, and we are expecting to get paperwork on 290, but it's not here yet. So we will go down the list here to 330. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 330. And we have Margaret DeLacy is here. And we have an amendment to this bill.
It's in the packet.
In the packet.
Read a summary and say what the amendment
Please
is.
Please do.
The original Senate Bill 330 provided funding for instruction for talented and gifted children based on a weighted average daily membership. It required school districts to provide instruction for talented and gifted children, and this would first apply in the 2012-2013 school year. We have an amendment that is in your packet, and that amendment -1 pretty much eliminates the first bill, and it creates a task force on the instruction of TAG children to determine possible resources, benefits, the number of children, and possible funding methods.
Okay. Margaret, do you want to speak to the amendment?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margaret DeLacy. I'm here testifying today on behalf of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. I would also like to say that since this is spring break, nobody's playing hooky here, we do have several parents and students who are here also supporting TAG services. They didn't want to testify, but I hope you'll have a chance to speak with them after the hearing.
Let's get the green button.
They are wearing, yes, they're wearing green tags, so you can see who they are. I've been listening with some interest to the testimony earlier today. I also would like to have more money for college scholarships and many other state services, but the bottom line is that we are at 90% of national income in Oregon. And if we want to fund services, we're an income tax state. If we want to fund services, even at the national level, much less at an exceptional level, it's going to be impossible if we don't do something about the fact that our income is at 90% of the national average. And the way to do that is to focus on investing our education dollars as strategically as possible. And the TAG students in the state are a big component of that. I'm sorry, I forgot to hand out my... you should have this already in your packets. If you don't, I brought some extra copies. Talented and Gifted Education has essentially not... funding for Talented and Gifted Education has really not increased in the past decade. We're pretty much where we were 10 years ago. Funding for other special needs students has increased substantially, although English language learning is down somewhat this session. At the same time, our state population has increased, which means that we have actually gone down in our spending for these students and for the potentially gifted students over the past 10 years. We simply can't afford to keep disinvesting in these students and hope to have a successful workforce. We requested the amendment to this bill because, like the other students you heard from today, we don't think that at this point we're in a position to be fighting among groups of students for resources. We think that we have a need to take a comprehensive look at how we can best serve and fund talented and gifted education in Oregon, and we think that this advisory committee is probably the best place to start. We'd like to bring everybody to the table, including our education groups, and see if we can come to some kind of consensus and come back to you next session with a proposal that everybody can get behind. I'd also like to say that there are many other ways that this committee can go about providing services to TAG students that do not involve an appropriation. In particular, we need more information and more accountability about how these services are being delivered now. House Bill 2180 would do that. It passed the House Education Committee last week. It should be on the way to your desk. I hope you will take it up and consider it seriously. It would enable the State Department of Education to have access to information from districts about what they're doing now for TAG students. We don't have that today. I'd also like to draw your attention to the fact that many other laws and bills you're considering this session have a direct and immediate impact on what happens to talented and gifted students in this state. For example, there are laws and bills that deal with acceleration, graduation, and early entry. You'll be hearing Senate Bill 24 next week that would have a fairly immediate effect on what happens to our TAG students in high school. You hear bills that deal with acceleration, graduation, and early entry, assessment, reporting, and teacher evaluation, licensure and professional development, policies on charter, magnet, and alternative schools, advanced placement, and dual credit. An advisory committee could look at all of these policies and come back with recommendations about how these could be tweaked to do a better job with these students. So, again, this would be a reason to consider that. And also, I would like to ask that you consider some of these issues when you look at these bills. I'd now like to ask if you have any questions for me.
Questions or comments?
I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Margaret, for continuing to work on this issue. I know it's been something you've been passionate about for quite some time. You passed out the chart about the expenditures, and I wonder if you have something that shows on a per-student basis. Because if I look at the total amount that's spent on TAG students and ESL students or ELL, whatever, and special ed, it doesn't show per student, and I wonder if you have that information.
Senator Bonamici, I don't have it in front of me. That table was provided to me by the Department of Education. I believe that ELL and TAG populations are roughly comparable in size. Special ed has been growing quite rapidly over the past decade, and the Oregon report card reports those numbers, so I could take them out of the Oregon report card, do the division, and send it to you.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful to see it at some point. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Margaret, is that bill in the House that you referenced? I know it's not the same as this bill, but would it serve as a substitute in keeping the discussion going to the amendment that you're offering on this bill?
Senator Haas, we believe that both bills should be passed in order to move forward on this. The House Bill 2180 requires school districts to send copies of plans that they are already required to have to the Department of Education. There was a drafting error made way back when the state first received a Javits grant in the 80s that allowed districts to send these district TAG plans in only if they were applying for the grant. It's never been corrected, and as a result, the state TAG specialist does not have access to district TAG plans, even though the TAG mandate requires that districts have the plans. And we think that this is something that an advisory committee would certainly want to take a look at if they convened, and so we would like them to have that information available to them.
Senator George.
Thank you very much. What kind of commitment are you seeing in other states for TAG in comparison to Oregon?
Chair Haas and Senator George, the level of commitment in states varies hugely from state to state. Unfortunately, the TAG has been such a low national priority that it's very difficult to get solid data. Different states fund TAG in different ways. For example, the state of Florida just does include TAG students as special education students. About three other states do that as well, and therefore they don't report their separate funding for TAG, and those are the states that actually tend to spend the most. Florida is one of them. Washington State is, I can give you the exact figure, but they're spending roughly $10 million per year on TAG. Most of the western states have fairly substantial budgets, but I've been trying to collect the data, and it's honestly just very difficult to get solid data state by state. The National Association for Gifted Children tries to provide that in its report every other year, but they also have difficulty in developing firm data for that. And again, there's a problem with allocating that per capita. I've also tried to do this. The NAGC thinks that that's probably not a good idea because the programs and services vary so widely from state to state, and what's covered in that fund also varies a lot.
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment? I might point out also that it varies. It's kind of hard to compare other states because if the class sizes are different, with a smaller class size, the teachers have more ability to differentiate curriculum within the classroom, but our class sizes are so big that it makes it more challenging for our teachers.
Mm-hmm. I will say that there's a huge variation from district to district in Oregon in the level of services that are provided. So a student born at one side of a boundary gets services that aren't available to a student who's born just across the street in a different district.
Okay. Well, thank you. We'll press on, and very much appreciate your advocacy on this subject. We'll look at the amendment. We don't have the fiscal analysis yet. Of course, we need that even if there is no fiscal impact.
We're hoping there will be minimal to no fiscal fiscal cost either for this or for House Bill 2180. And I'd just like to say thank you to the committee for continuing to take an interest in these students.
Thank you. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 330, and we have nothing back yet on Senate Bill 290, so we will stand at ease for a moment while Senator Atkinson makes it down here for Senate Bill. And I'd like to open a public hearing on SJR 24. Senator Jason Atkinson is here.
Thank you.
Welcome, sir.
Mr. Chair, I believe this is SJR 23. Is that correct?
24.
81 days?
Yes. Mm-hmm. 81 days?
Wonderful. I have shown it as a different number. That's fine. Mr. Chair, thank you. I was next door as we were voting on block 30 zillion people to names and boards and commissions. So I apologize for that. For the record, I'm Jason Atkinson. I represent a good portion of Southern Oregon. And I'm very thankful that you have elected to hear this bill. For me, I'm delighted to have the hearing because for so many years, this bill wouldn't get a hearing until I made a very large case for it outside of the building. And perhaps one of the secret victories that made me smile was in the last governor's race, both candidates were asked about the 81-day bill, and they both had to speak of their interest in the bill with various shades of interest. But what made me smile so much about that was is the word or the number 81 comes from me many years ago, and it came from me actually at the place where I write most of my speeches, which is the shower. I was standing in the shower trying to figure out how could I have a pass education first bill that wouldn't land on April Fool's Day. And so it was actually 81 would never land on April Fool's Day under the old rules, and that's how it has become part of political rhetoric both during campaign season and here. So I bring this to you today with a lot of excitement, and let me just very quickly explain why I've landed on this bill the way it is as a referral. I will tell you that outside of this building, away from the influences that are upon so many of us as making decisions, people actually understand this very well. People on both sides of the aisle, Republican, Democrats, parents and educators, always seem to ask, how come you don't pass education first? How come there's no stability, as we all know during campaign season, in K-12 funding? And so with that, I started to look structurally at why is it that a state of less than 4 million people would take 6 months to pass the budget that 91 politicians, House, Senate, and one governor all campaign on as the priority? I mean, there's a truth in spending, or in marketing, rather, that has always been phenomenal to me as both a participant and as a student of campaigns. We all know where campaign support falls by way of education, but yet everyone who runs for office has the picture of them with children where they have the mail piece that says education is our priority, and yet when we get here, historically it's the very last budget to pass. When I began in the legislature, K-12 funding was at $4.1 billion. And I broke ranks, much to the near heart attack of the then Speaker of the House, when I crossed party lines to join this other renegade freshman named Randall Edwards, and I joined on a $5.1 budget. And as things trickled along, we got out of session, and I learned that Republicans had cut education, even though education funding had gone up, I think, about $300 million that year. And I started asking myself, well, not only is that not true, but I think I've been gamed. I think that the system of education funding has set me up for failure. And so I started to study and started to learn how this would work. And it has been my experience that we come in January, And the governor gives a State of the State address in which, regardless of governor, and regardless of party, however it's been one party for 30 years, but regardless of party, the governor says, and it's about the children and education, and it's our future, and it's a fabulous applause line for the legislature. And then we go on about our business of spending money on budgets that are not as high of priority. I mean, nobody, R or D, would say that $50,000 here and $200,000 here for various commissions are nearly the weight of over half the state's budget, which is education. And over half the state's budget, or the mortgage payment, is then said, well, let's wait till the March forecast, we'll get more money. And then we come to March, and we've spent money for about 3 months on various budgets. And then we say, well, we got to wait till the May forecast because we'll get more money. By the time May rolls around, typically, we have spent more than the 9 to 10% of money that we have in flux around here, and we've gotten to about 15 or 20% of the state's budget. Then when it comes time for us to pass over half, K through 12, and then pass public safety and health and human services, we have far escaped where we started from, and it becomes a spending crisis. The part about this is policymakers on the education committee that is so important is we do a tremendous disservice to three groups of people by the way we've done it. The first group of people is school boards. School boards are required to submit their budgets to the legislature, to the state, far in advance of knowing what the number is. Secondly, and in my district, I have a very small elementary school called Sam's Valley. Sam's Valley is part of District 6, which is in the Central Point School District. I have the other two groups of people are signified in that particular school, as I have parents very worried that their school is going to be closed down, and I have teachers that are looking for jobs elsewhere simply because the school board hasn't been able to balance the budget because we, the budget makers, haven't given it to them. And, of course, that's more than Sam's Valley. Of course, it's more than the school district of Road River, but it plays throughout the entire state. But as I will tell you all, which the committee, this August education committee, is mostly Northern Oregon north of Albany, I will tell you that south of Eugene and east of Bend, this is a real issue. And so simply, I have created a bill that would require us to pass the education budget first. I have structural changes, Mr. Chair, that I believe Senator Morris has heard on changing the revenue forecast, too. Two things that have made absolutely not one cent of difference on the K-12 budget is the May forecast, and the other thing is the politics of delay. How can a state the size of Florida, Texas, Kentucky, California, Washington, and Idaho each pass their K-12 budget faster than we can? It's because we've gotten used to doing it this way. So before the good senator, the brilliant legal mind of Senator Bonamici asks, what happens, though, Senator, if we pass the wrong budget and we come back and we find out that it's not enough or there's more money? Well, certainly, it's the prerogative of us, the holders of the checkbook, or more accurately described, after Measure 5 passed in the early 1990s, the legislature now is the super school board. That used to be a concern. And I, to ask that question, I tell you, that was actually the soft underbelly of this issue. Now, with annual sessions, it actually has solved itself. Whether we're talking about revenue forecasting or prioritizing K-12 as what it should be, the priority, we now have the ability to pass it first with very little risk, as we might say, based on the revenue forecast. So I'm delighted, Mr. Chair, that you've heard the bill. The 81 days, I don't want you to say, think of me in the shower, but it is the it is the small amount of poetic justice when I hear it around campaign season. But I really am an firm believer. I'm a lover of the process. I'm a lover of public service. But I think this one thing we have in Oregon is overly partisan and is not completely honest when it comes to why do we take so long to pass the budget we all say is the priority. And that's really where this SGR is coming from. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would be delighted to answer any questions.
Thank you. The brilliant mind of Senator Bonamici wants to ask about cutting pay.
I actually, you anticipated one of my questions. I have another question, and that's what happens if there's a leap year? Then might the 81st day be on April Fool's Day?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's a risk I'm willing to take. Now, I will tell you that I originally had written the bill. When this started to get statewide traction, I had written the bill unconstitutionally. And that was pass it in 81 days or all of us lose our pay, which was a really great way of selling the bill and really didn't make very much difference because we don't get paid very much anyway. However, I think with the leap year, at least on the fog of the mirror of the shower, I still doesn't land on April Fool's.
Mr. Chair, I actually had a real question. I wondered about the compensation. The version we have still shows that the legislators lose compensation if they don't pass the budget on the 81st day. And I wonder if it's in the Constitution, is there some indication that your fellow legislators don't comply with the Constitution?
No, and that might have been, I forgive me, I've brought down, there might be another companion bill, but when I signed out the LC request form under the check mark, has this been introduced before? I think the version you're looking at had that, but I'll tell you that's unconstitutional. However, I have been absolutely fascinated to my Democratic colleagues who have gone to public meetings and town halls or campaigned and talked about this, and the welcome response that we get from Democratic faithful in campaigns and from Republican faithful in campaigns. And it's very difficult to explain why we wait till the May forecast to pass the budget. In fact, it really doesn't make... It makes sense in this building, almost, but it makes zero sense in my experience outside the building.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Thank you. I note that your comments about there hasn't been a Republican governor in 30 years, but you could change that.
No, not after the year I've had. Thank you very much for hearing it. And I would ask you to take it under consideration. And I would ask the committee to do this. I would ask you this weekend, when you're trying to massage your brain away from the stress of this building, to ask yourself, is there a thread of truth to what I'm saying? I believe there is. I really believe that waiting till May based on a broken revenue forecast that is all political and has, in my, since 1999, two centuries of service now, hasn't changed the budget at all. The only thing standing in the way of us prioritizing is ourselves, because we've always done it that way. And Mr. Chair, you and I both know just because we've always done it that way is really not a very good excuse for doing business. And so I would ask you all to consider this and perhaps be the brave committee that would forward it on to the people, because I believe bipartisanly it would pass. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And to close the public hearing on SJR 24. And I'm going to go into a work session on Senate Bill 290. If you could update us, Administrator Lindholm.
Yes. Senate Bill 290 directs the State Board of Higher Education, in consultation with the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, to adopt core teaching standards to assist school districts in determining the effectiveness of teachers and administrators. We do have an amendment that was adopted on March 8th by this committee, and that amendment adds the concept of improving teacher practices and professional development in order to improve student growth and learning outcomes.
Okay, I'm going to open up a... we're in work session. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 290.
Do we have to send it to us?
And I'm not sure if we need any testimony. Anybody needs to weigh in here? Senator Morris, if you...
Do we have a subsequent? I notice there's a $54,000 fiscal...
Just got this back. $53,655. A minimal expenditure.
Looks like the TSPC is minimal, but the ODE is $53,655.
Well, we do have a rule. Cindy Robert. One of the authors.
Mr. Chair, Cindy Robert with the Chalkboard Project. And you're curious about the fiscal?
Well, we have a rule that we can't send it to the floor, and I didn't know if you would consider with some of your colleagues reworking an amendment or whatever it might take to either get this amendment down, or we'll send it to Ways and Means.
What do you guys want to do? It's kind of an odd fiscal number, isn't it? $53,000.
It's well, it's an integer.
Only divisible by itself.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. You know, we have no way of arguing with this number. It's presumably based on somebody's salary. We're still working on who gets four times that amount, but over there. But if it goes to Ways and Means, we certainly can work with it down there. We're not uncomfortable that this bill would get lost in the Ways and Means process. We think we've got it, a spotlight on it, and it has some level of interest for all.
Chair, just for clarification, Cindy Robert, Chalkboard Project, I'm always somewhat uncomfortable, so I
well, we will help her.
Thank you.
Well, we did get a rush job on this fiscal analysis, and we were told that a longer version is coming in the next day or two. So why don't we do this? Why don't we just hold off on doing anything until we see the full analysis and go from there?
Mr. Chair, I would just add that I don't think it will go down. I think it will go up. I think that the person who did, I'm sorry, but I think the person who did the analysis, John Turpin, has made it clear in the, I think it's last paragraph, that he thinks there will be some fiscal impact on school districts for implementing this program. And so I can't see that it would go down. I'm just trying to save your time. I would think that it might go up.
Just a thought on the impact on school districts. At least at this point, Ms. Chairman, you are not bound by the impact on school districts of anything you pass. I know that has. I know you know that.
Okay. Larry, Mo, and I are going to.
All right. So I do, committee. If it's okay with you, I let's just hold off until we get the full analysis and.
That's a good idea.
Over.
They might be able to work something out.
So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 290, and if there is no other business, then we are adjourned.